Hi, everybody. This is Frank Leipold, the Generate podcast. And today it's just me because my co-host Isabella is sick. She doesn't have a voice. So I apologize. You just have to only work with me and a very special guest with Bastien Joubert. Bastien is working in Lyon in one of the, or let me say, the expert center in perineal plastics and autoimmune encephalitis in France and worldwide. They for sure have a global leadership, especially in anything that has to do with tumors, tumor-associated diseases, perineal plastic diseases, and of note, also a very, very big footprint in the field of immune checkpoint inhibitors. And so after, you know, making him blush a little bit, here's Bastien Joubert. And thank you very much for being on the podcast. Great to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you. And it's very nice to be here. Thank you for the nice presentation.
You're very welcome. Well deserved. But having, you know, make people a little curious about you. So how did someone end up in medicine? Maybe this is what people might ask, being interested in tumor-associated diseases in neurology and in the, you know, more recent specialization you may have. What triggered you? I mean, what happened? How did you end where you are now?
Well, I can't say I really anticipated this. It came really little by little, opportunity after opportunity. In med school, I was very much interested in autoimmune disorders. And for some reasons, I switched to neurology. So it felt natural that somehow I ended up studying neuroimmunological disorders. And after that, a little bit randomly, I ended up in Lyon for my residency, my neurology training. And it's where I met Jérôme Honorat, which became later my mentor. And we started with very little things. It worked well. I was very much interested in this field. I also met patients, very interesting patients clinically, but also very moving stories, personal stories that really hooked me in that field. And yeah, little by little, I became more involved in clinical research mostly. And then I had the opportunity to, it was very nice to him, I met Joseph Dalmau, who suggested that I spend some time, I suppose like you did, in his lab, which which really broadened my perspective. It made me discover what really is translational research and so on. So this really was a very foundational for me. And when I came back to France, I had the opportunity to take a position in a general hospital when they have tons of oncology departments. And it was by combining this and the French Network for Paraneoplastic Neurological Syndrome, I suddenly had access to many people with complications, side effects of cancer treatment, including immunotherapy. And it was really a boom at this time. So, yeah, it was opportunity after opportunity. And I don't know, still maybe just willing to work on this, and little by little, this path build itself, I'd say.
That is super interesting. And having talked to several people, you know, in general, but also in this podcast, I think there's a common theme evolving in everybody who's been successful. I mean, there's three things. I think there's index patients, and I mean, you mentioned that, you alluded to this. There's mentors like Jérôme and Joseph for you.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's serendipity, right? So you have to be at the right situation at the right moment and just grasping opportunities. And this is, I think, a story many people can relate to who basically have made a career, but maybe also people who are, you know, in the process of building a career. I mean, these are the three things which I think make up a successful career, right? What's your...
Yeah, so serendipity is absolutely vital, but it occurs also all the time. So you also have to be ready. I sure I missed some opportunities, but other I took because somehow I was ready at that time. And I suppose it's the same for everybody in the field.
Yeah, that's true. So talking about index patients very quickly, I mean, we actually had this theme coming up several times, and people could often, you know, name the single patient on the team.
Yeah, I can. I can.
Small group of patients. So who is it? Tell us about him or her.
I was a very young resident. It feels funny telling my life like this, but I was a very young resident. I think I was in, it was my second year of residency. And I was in a neurology department in which we were very alone, which means very free. And I had to take care of a patient with a known paraneoplastic mesenteric gravis. And this guy became suddenly very ill, lost, I don't know, 20 kilos, very sweaty. He couldn't sleep. He had vivid hallucination and his muscles were twitching a lot. I didn't know anything about Morvan syndrome at this time.
That was a spoiler. You should have spoiled that. Okay, please go on.
And I think no one around me either. It was in, I don't know, 2011 maybe. And it was tricky because at this time we didn't test the antibodies in the serum. And in our hands, at least, these patients have these antibodies, Caspar-2 antibodies only in the serum, not in the CSF. So it was actually tricky to make the diagnosis, but eventually we did. And I don't know, this guy was a very nice person. We had a very nice relation. I was very young, very little experience. And it really moved me. So, yeah. And from this case, I started, I discussed this case with Jérôme. I presented this case at French, very local congresses. And I think it was a little bit when our collaboration with Jérôme sparked and he started to trust me and giving me little works. And
yeah, so very quick detour. Actually, I saw my very first Morvan syndrome patient in 2002 when I was still in med school. The only thing is nobody recognized it back then. Yeah. So I only realized many years later what it really was. It was a Libyan patient, really sick, had a thymoma, nobody knew what he had. And eventually also we couldn't help him. So, but this, what it was, only became obvious many, many years later. He even had low titer acetylcholine receptor antibodies and so on. So, but please, maybe we might have lost some of our listeners. Can you quickly explain the Morvan syndrome, what listeners should know about this? Maybe not everybody is familiar with this syndrome.
Yeah, it's a very strange syndrome. It's very little understood, actually. It ranges among the Caspar-2 associated disorders. So it's associated with Caspar-2 antibodies. And as far as I know, it's always associated with these antibodies, but they are usually at lower titers than other Caspar-2 associated disorders. For instance, the titers are lower than in Caspar-2 associated limbic encephalitis, for instance, for some reason. And it combines symptoms of peripheral nerve hyperexcitability, which are usually very severe. Dysautonomia is prominent with profuse sweating. The blood pressure is very dysregulated. You can see discolorations of the tubes. But they have also motor hyperexcitability with myokemia that are often very impressive. I don't know, this is a very peculiar sign that oftentimes the tubes are moving by themselves because of this hyperexcitability.
Didn't know.
And they can also complain often of pain, neuropathic pain. So this is for the peripheral nerve hyperexcitability. And you can detect it on the nerve conduction studies with these spontaneous activities. So nerve conduction study people really know how to recognize this pattern. So if you are in doubt, you can always do the nerve conduction and then CS, and you will have your answer. So, but Morvan syndrome is not only that, it's also a very weird sleep disorder. And the connection between the two aspects of this syndrome is really not clear to me. This sleep disorder is very severe. The patients lose completely their deep sleep stages, and they only keep very short REM sleep periods interspersed with stage one sleep. So they almost don't sleep in practice. And when they do sleep, it's in very short bursts during which they have vivid dreams that they experience as real life, as a hallucination, basically. So if you have patients that are exhausted and hallucinating all the time, and in addition to that, they have this profuse sweating, dysautonomia. They lose weight, can be 10, 20 kilos. I don't know why. So it's a very impressive syndrome. We had the opportunity in one patient. It's a very rare, possibly because it's under-recognized, but I do think it's still quite rare. And we had the opportunity to, in one patient, to do a brain FDG PET scan showing a hypometabolism of the frontal lobe, but we didn't see the classical striatal hypermetabolism that you see in the limbic encephalitis patients. So probably it's different structures are involved in the two disorders. But the good thing is, in our experience, at least, these patients respond very well and quickly and consistently to rituximab. So, and they are usually after rituximab, in our experience, they don't relapse. So it's really important to identify them because they can really die from this complication at the acute phase. But then once treated, they do pretty well.
Oh, that was a great experience. Thank you. But, you know, several things come up, maybe also questions. First of all, so the sleep disorder has a certain name, right? It's agrypnea.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting what it is called.
Excitata. Agrypnea, excitata. It's the interesting thing about the sleep disorder is that it's supposedly it's exactly the same pattern as in fatal familial insomnia. Which
a prion disease.
Yeah, a hereditary prion disease, super rare. Which is due to the degeneration of two very specific subnuclei of the thalamus. So I don't know, but it's very possible that Morvan disease is due to some impairment in the structure, or at least the networks implied in the structures. It's not very clear, but it's a really interesting hypothesis.
Two more small things. I mean, one is the tumor association. I mean, Caspar-2 is rarely associated to tumors, of course, but what about Morvan and Caspar?
Yeah, we found that when you stratify patients with Caspar-2 antibodies, when we stratify them by the syndrome, either typical limbic encephalitis versus Morvan syndrome, the paraneoplastic ones were the Morvan syndrome, and they are all, in most cases, it was a thymoma, very aggressive thymoma, B2, B3. So, and in the other hand, the limbic encephalitis patients, they had an HLA allele, which the Morvan syndrome patients did not have. So probably the immunological mechanisms that underlie these two disorders are pretty different.
And they can sometimes also have LJ1 co-positivity, right?
Yeah,
they have.
It's probably maybe because possibly Caspar-2 is not the only or the main antigen. And because I think this is due to the thymoma underlying this disease, which is very disruptive for the immunity. So these patients, they have also LJ1, they have also acetylcholine receptor antibodies, like in myasthenia gravis, and they can have also other antibody. There was a paper about natrine receptor antibodies. Just probably a long list.
Great. We can pick this up here, and let's talk about tumors and thymomas and tumor associated diseases. First of all, let's again, if I may ask for an explainer, paraneoplastic neurological syndromes. Give us a 1 minute heads up. I know it's a challenge. You can talk about this for hours, but let's try to do 1 to 2 minutes. Explain what this is.
So it's a group of rare neurological disorders, autoimmune neurological disorders that are triggered by the presence of a cancer, and they are associated with antibodies. These antibodies are used to confirm the diagnosis when they are positive. The clinical presentations are highly diverse, but there are sets of so-called high-risk syndromes that are more often seen in a paraneoplastic context. That's, for instance, limbic encephalitis. So the clinical presentation is memory deficits and seizures and behavioral changes, but also cerebral ataxia, rarer things like obsequious myoclonus, Lambert-Eaton syndromes, and so on. But in practice, anything, virtually anything neurologic that presents subacutely in days to week could be paraneoplastic if you don't have any other explanation. So you have criteria to estimate the probability that your syndrome the patient have is paraneoplastic. And depending on this criteria, you should be more or less thorough in your research for an underlying malignancy. And I just want to stress out the limitation of the antibody test because we have some problems with the specificity of this antibody. So you have to be very careful when you have a positive test that it is concordant with the cancer you eventually you may find or the clinical presentation.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, this is probably the biggest issue I encounter in everyday life, that people call me and they say, okay, I've got this, I don't know.
Why you antibody?
Patient with whatever, with viral antibodies, and she's a Mayo patient. I mean, you don't need much more information than that to guess what happened, right? So incongruent lab result, non-confirmatory testing. It's an issue, but one more question. The top five tumors associated with paraneoplastic syndromes that one has to think of when you have a suspicion. So what should you screen for?
Well, lung cancer, obviously, small cell lung cancer and lung adenocarcinoma. Thymoma, breast and gynecological cancer are top cancers. What else?
People keep asking me about the skin cancers, the Merkel cell carcinomas. I think it's extremely rare, right? It can happen. It can be neuroendocrine, but unusual, right? Okay.
Yeah. Sorry. No, in many cases, the cancer is not very much disseminated. So, I forgot one important one. The testicular cancer are very important in males, especially if you have cerebral ataxic presentation.
But lymphoma, probably.
Lymphoma is tricky because if you suspect lymphoma, you should avoid steroids before the biopsy. So you need to have a very quick biopsy, which can bring us to another thing, is the urgency of identifying the underlying tumor. And this urgency is always not very well understood by the oncologist or the surgeons, because these patients often have a very small tumors, very little disseminated tumors, or sometimes it's just a small lymph node of 15 or 20 millimeters. So they don't want to go to biopsy that. And for us, it's extremely important to have diagnosis and also to remove the tumor, which is probably continues to stimulate the immune system. So it's a real challenge in practice. And we need to be very, very strong in our discussions with the surgeons and oncologists about that, I think.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, this is where the importance of conferences, of like neurological, oncological, surgical conferences comes up, right? I mean, they're important. Absolutely. In general, but in these diseases, this is a game changer, because you can get everybody at a table, that you need to be the advocate of your patient, stressing the importance of time and treatment. And this is definitely one of the messages I think everybody out there should listen to. Whenever you have a patient with a paraneoplastic disease, sit down as soon as possible with everybody and tell them how important it is to get rid of the tumor as fast as possible, right? Mm. But how do you get rid of it? Well, probably depends, but this is a very great avenue to our next topic. So let's talk about immune checkpoint inhibitors. And I know this has been one of the defining themes of your research of the last years.
Recently.
More recently, because they are not around, have not been around for many, many years. But tell us about what they do and how this relates to paraneoplastic neurological diseases, why we need to discuss them in one context, maybe.
So it's a really fascinating topic, unfortunate for the patients, but very fascinating for us. You know that immune checkpoint inhibitors have been developed by oncologists. Now, I think it's 10 years ago, probably, it started. And they basically act by boosting, stimulating the immune system indiscriminately, so that T cells specific for tumor antigen can attack tumor cells and destroy them. And it's pretty efficient in many cancers. For instance, it was first used in melanoma patients, and it has radically transformed the prognosis of these patients. So it was really a great progress in oncology, and it still is. They have a little disadvantage. They trigger autoimmune disorders that can affect any organ, and in as much as 40% of the patients. Usually, you can treat that pretty easily with steroids, but some patients develop very severe and difficult to treat toxicities, for instance, myocarditis or other ones, and rarely the nervous system is affected. This is where we are involved.
How rare is rare in this context? Can you maybe put in that?
It's difficult to say, actually, because this, strange enough, these toxicities do not appear in trials, in stage three trials. Maybe it's too rare, maybe it's under-recognized, maybe the patients are selected in some way. I don't really know, but they don't appear very much. But in clinical practice, it's estimated that between 1% and 5%, probably it's closer to 2%. It's still not very clear. So it's pretty rare. And on top of that, it's highly diverse, heterogeneous in terms of clinical presentation. You have the top one is myositis. I don't know if you really can call myositis a neurological adverse event, but it's still classified as one. So myositis, which often combines with myocarditis, which makes it pretty so severe. And the second one is polyradicular neuropathy, a little bit like a Guillain-Barré syndrome, with a demyelinating pattern on the NCS. And after that, you have encephalitis patients, and this becomes tricky. Encephalitis itself is very heterogeneous. And it appears that you have at least broadly two groups of patients. Those who have very diffuse encephalitis with fever, high CRP in the blood. They can have a great diversity of symptoms, including movement disorders, fluctuation of consciousness, seizures, and so on. Sometimes myelitis. Usually the CSF is very inflammatory, which is very high cell counts. But these patients, they do usually well, and they respond quickly to steroids, most of them. The myelitis part can be a little bit difficult to treat, but the rest of the symptoms usually respond well to steroids. And this is one we called meningoencephalitis. I'm not sure if that's the best term, but this is the best we could find. And on the other hand, you have patients who have very focal encephalitis syndromes, limbic encephalitis, cerebral ataxia, mostly, sometimes with brainstem involvement. And these patients really look like paraneoplastic encephalitis patients. They have the same antibodies, they have the same cancer associations. They also respond very poorly to treatment. So there is probably a mechanistic overlap between classical PNS that occurs spontaneously and triggered PNS that occurs in ICI-treated patients. And I really believe that it's really essential to understand what is this common ground so we can find new avenues, new treatment possibilities for post-ICI and encephalitis patients, but also for patients with spontaneous PNS. And I think it will be very, very important to work on this.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I completely agree. I think it's one of the outstanding parts of your work really is this definition of the different types and attaching also different prognosis a little bit, the treatment response to it. The first
I owe that to Jerome, I think. It was his teaching. He always had this approach of trying to, you know, cut groups of patients into tiny homogeneous subgroups. And I think in most cases, he's right to do that because the clinical differences are often underlined by mechanistic immunological differences. So grouping the patients well, the nosological classifications is probably essential to progress on the understanding of the immunological mechanisms of these patients. And Joe taught me that.
Yeah, I mean, this is, shows his longstanding scientific expertise. And I think this is also where, let me call it Jerome's school, Joseph's school, basically converge, right? I mean, this phenomenological, clinical phenotypization, take it very serious, make an utmost effort into really delineating differences and similarities in your clinical groups. This will eventually lead you to true knowledge on mechanistics and therapeutic effects. I totally agree. When do we expect those toxicities to occur after initiating the immune checkpoint inhibitor treatment? So first course, second course. So can you give us a rule of thumb for clinicians?
It's usually early in the first 2-3 months, but it depends a lot on the type of toxicity. Myositis, for instance, is super early, usually after the first or second infusion. Polyradicular neuropathy comes a little bit later, I would say after 2-4 infusions, but it's still pretty early. And for the encephalitis, it can be much, very much more delayed. I don't have the numbers. It's really my gut feeling that you need a little bit more time. I would say 1 month at least, 2 months, but it can be up to 6 months after the onset, the initiation of the ICI. Later than 6 months, I would say it's a little bit, it can occur, but it may be something else. And the alternative, considering the alternative diagnosis is super important because this toxicity is super rare, while other causes, tumor progression, metabolic problems, toxicities of other origins, are probably more frequent, so they should be considered as well.
What are your top red flags that occur in the patient who is under treatment with immune checkpoint inhibitors that everybody, especially oncologists, should pay attention to so they know when to call the neurologist, or the neurologist should pay attention to when they do an examination of those patients?
Memory deficits are always overlooked by oncologists who think that the patient is tired, a little bit too old, that kind of thing. And we have a very alarming number of 40% of these patients who are kept on ICIs in spite of the onset of the neurological symptoms. And I think it tells a lot about the lack of awareness of this toxicity by the oncologist. But I also had stories of patients who became ataxic and the alarm was not given for some reason. So probably these patients, they go to the oncological department, they receive their chemo and they just go home and they are not very much examined. Yeah. So there is a lot of work to do regarding oncologist awareness, but also patients' awareness. And another problem, I think, is that some oncologists, they are very keen on calling neurologists, but there is not any to come and see the patient quickly. So we have also to be organized, to be reactive, to improve this patient's care. So the top symptoms, actually, they are, as I said, the patient can have ataxia, limbic encephalitis. These symptoms are known by neurologists, but probably they are not called or they do not come to see the patient soon enough.
Yeah. So maybe a question came up that actually I have no clue if we know the answer, but probably you do. How often do neurological symptoms, toxicities associate with systemic toxicities or to
phrase it? That's a very good point. That's a very interesting question. I don't remember the numbers actually exactly, but it depends on the toxicity. The paraneoplastic-like ones, usually do occur in isolation, probably because the mechanisms are different. But meningoencephalitis, myositis, polyradicular neuropathy, oftentimes you have other toxicities, skin, endocrine is very frequent.
Yes.
You name it. So it's important to look after this one, especially since some could mimic neurological disorder. Hypophysitis could mimic neurological toxicity. profound. I saw once a patient with a profound hypothyroidism, yes, and everybody thought he had myositis, for instance, because of the myopathy. So
that's super interesting. So you're saying the systemic toxicities associated to the generalized syndrome you've coined, encephalomyelitis and polyradiculitis, so on, while the focal encephalitis variants do not necessarily associate. So basically, seeing a patient who has not had a lot of toxicities or none does not preclude him from eventually still developing after several months of treatment a focal encephalitis like limbic encephalitis. Interesting for me and probably also for the listeners. So unfortunately, we have to come to the end. I mean, we could continue to talk for hours, actually. No, this is wonderful. Thank you so much. I think it's perfect. It's on time and everybody will have listened super fascinated to this, and I'm really serious. So final things, let's talk about maybe also about the treatment and a little bit about the future and maybe where the research is heading. So the treatment, how should we treat the patients with the ICI neurological toxicities? You've mentioned steroids. That's it? Or do we, how long did we do it? How do we start? Anything else? Or is it only steroids? What's your answer? I know it's non-evidence-based, but give us your best gut feeling and knowledge from cases.
So the key treatment is to first stop the ICI. It's sometimes forgotten, and treat the patient with steroids. And since it's a very severe, it's usually very severe toxicities, you give high-dose steroids intravenously, and then oral steroids at high dose, 1 mg/kg per day. And this has to be kept for at least several weeks and taper down very slowly. And the taper is super important because patients can relapse. And when they do, they usually do it during taper. So a very slow tapering is important. So that's when the patient responds well to steroids. I think you have to consider what we called second line therapy. So rituximab, cyclophosphamide, maybe tocilizumab. In two situations, when patients do not quickly improve with steroids, and the second situation in patients with paraneoplastic-like disorders or patients who are positive for antibodies, high-risk paraneoplastic antibodies, HU, MA2, and the like. These two situations are higher risk of patients becoming dependent on the long term. So you have to consider second-line therapy. The choice of which is really not clear, and I think you should reach a specialist with experience to discuss these difficult cases. Another important thing is I think the patient has to be treated quickly because we realized recently that after maybe 2-3 months, the patient stopped improving. And if you don't treat them soon enough, it's too late. And the other important question is when to restart the ICI, if and when. And it's an important question because on the long term, these patients have a high mortality that is due to cancer progression. So this is an unsolved question, but we have to ask this again and again to ourselves and to the oncologist when managing these patients.
This is super important also, not only the immunosuppressive treatment, but the re-challenging. So you are, I know some of your data, of course, but still, please give us your answer. It's not absolutely prohibited to start ICI, in contrast, right? But what would you tell an oncologist to tell you? I mean, come on, this guy has had autoimmunity after ICI. I can't give it to him anymore. What do you tell him?
It's a matter of balance between the risk you expect and the benefits. It's clear that if your patient had a very severe toxicity, did not improve, is MRS 4 or 5, maybe it's not worth the risk. But if your patient has improved a lot, and he will be killed eventually by this tumor, you have at least to talk with him or her and discuss this opportunity. And our data at the moment is pretty comforting that most patients do not relapse when we re-challenge them with ICIs.
Yeah, that has been published recently, right? We will link some of the papers.
I think. No, not yet.
No, not yet. Going, oh, so sorry. Great. So it's going, unpublished result, yeah.
It's going to be.
But then we'll eventually try to link it to the episode when it's out. Great. Final question. So where's the research heading? I mean, you mentioned many of the needs we have to find out in yep. this field. But what do you think? What are the next steps? What should we do as a field in general, beyond France, within France, so within Europe?
The post-ICI toxicities or everything?
Well, everything is probably going to be a big stretch and we'll need another 30 minutes. But let's yeah. concentrate on the ICI for this question.
Yeah. Well, we have to progress on two things, I think. First is the clinical research. So we need bigger cohorts. We need something that is more prospective to have a more homogeneous set of data so we can really compare patients. And we had these discussions already, but it's now probably time to collaborate and have proper registries, not just trying to collect data from the different hospitals as we do. So it's not an easy thing to do, depending on the country. For instance, I think in the Netherlands, they have a very good system where every patient is centralized into one hospital. This is great, but it's not realistic in my countries or yours probably. So we had to find other ways, and registry managed by different groups that have expertise could be a solution, but that needs coordination, time and money. But I think it's really the next step forward to have good quality data. On the clinical level. On the translational level, these diseases are a great opportunity to better understand the relation between cancer immunity, neuroimmune disorders, and ultimately improve, identify new biomarkers to monitor the patients, to diagnose the patients, and also for novel therapeutic targets. And we really need to take that opportunity to do these kind of studies. And especially since now we have new technologies, you know very well the single cell transcriptomics we can use to analyze the patient's cells in their CSF, in the peripheral blood, in their tumor. It's expensive. You have to find the fundings for this, but there is really new avenues for research. And I think it's really exciting. We are in a very exciting moment, I think, because PNS have been a nightmare since the 1960s, right? We haven't made really much progress except on the clinical characterization. And I really believe that now we have maybe a path forward to improve the management of these patients. And this is really great.
Excellent points, all three very well, especially the last one. I think for people maybe a little bit outside the field, paraneoplastic patients are probably the biggest need in the field. We can do much more for many of the more common encephalitis variants than we can do for those, especially for some of the disease we haven't even touched here, like YO, PCD, which is a terrible disease. But we'll talk about this also with a colleague of you, Virginie Desestes, these days. She'll be talking about the tumor part of this. So this is a little bit of a... like an alert for the next podcast. So thanks, Bastien. This was excellent. Sharing your insights, maybe also, or not maybe, but also volunteering some unpublished information here. Fantastic. It was super interesting. I think everybody enjoyed it. I enjoyed it tremendously. So with this, I say thank you to you. Thank you to the listeners and to everybody from the podcast community. And we are looking forward to some of the next episodes. And we'll have you back on the podcast eventually with maybe some more information, new data, other aspects.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.